Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for July 1st, 2013. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast in which I discuss several of the stories that caught my attention over the past few weeks, including Restart, a project to help people fix their broken devices and learn more about repairing technology, some research that could eventually turn your cell phone into a sort of echolocating super sensor, the development risks inherent in HTML5 as a new upcoming technology, and Microsoft reverses its stance on its controversial game licensing policies. All of this and more. First, though, before I get started, I do want to give a quick review. It's been a while since I've done one of these. In this instance, in the interest of fair disclosure, this was an audiobook that was offered to me by the publisher. That's the Pragmatic Bookshelf. These are the folks behind The Pragmatic Programmer, one of my all-time favorite books that has nothing to do with their offer of this audiobook. I bought that book ages ago and actually have been a big fan of the work that they've done since in building up a big brand. So I thought it was very natural, even if this was not necessarily a book I would have picked off the shelf myself. Well, in this case, picked out of the audio download section anyway. Myself, I thought it was fair in terms of how I generally approach these reviews. In this instance, the book in question, Pomodoro Technique Illustrated, The Easy Way to Do More in Less Time, I think it actually shows a little bit just on the audio quality side. And granted, you have to take this with a grain of salt of someone who's been podcasting now for over 8 years, that there was a little bit of a distraction in terms of, I think, mostly the mastering, that they mastered this at a slightly lower bit rate than I would have liked. So there was a little bit of distortion I picked up on. Probably most of their audience isn't even going to notice that. The performance of the narrator here, whose name I will not try to pronounce, I'll include a link in the show notes to the audio title in question so you can see the original author's name and the narrator's name, all the details, including how you can get this book. But I think in terms of the performance of the piece, I think it struck a pretty good balance in terms of being listenable, but there were clearly some awkward spots where I think just the structuring is more of a technical book could have done with a bit more sound design. So some bumpers, some stingers, something to just break things up and to give you the sort of audio cues to replace the visual cues you normally get in section headers. I do think, to the credit of the narrator, they really did try to do that. I think it was just an issue of needing a little bit more. In terms of the content of the book, I think that if you are a fan of sort of software process methodology, of productivity techniques, this is going to be right up your alley. And I think what I liked about this the most, even though I wasn't on the lookout for something like this, is that it's very similar to Scrum, something I've been formally trained on in the past, a software, or actually a project management technique, to be fair. It's not specific to software. That's self-adapting, that there are mechanisms built in to revisit and think about how the technique is working for you and to adjust it, to customize it to your own personal approach. I like that in general, and I like very specifically techniques like this one, like Scrum, that take that into account. So if you're looking for a productivity technique, an approach that's simpler than, say, getting things done, the 43 folders approach, something that's adaptable, that really puts an emphasis much more on focus, but does provide some very clever, I think, ways of applying heuristics to measure your ability to be productive and to make better estimation, I think that this may be something that's worth checking out on those points. And again, as I mentioned earlier, if any of that recommends this book to you, that it's something that you may wish to explore to help out with your own personal productivity needs. Again, this is a personal technique, not necessarily one designed for teams, although I could see an adaptation, but there are plenty of other good choices out there. Then I seriously suggest that you click on the links that I'll include in the show notes check out the free excerpt, consider getting a copy of any of the audio formats available, including, most impressively, Ogvorbis. All of them are DRM-free. Or, if audio's not your chosen format, there are also links from the audiobook back to the electronic and other versions to check out as well. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. Slashdot linked to a dark reading piece by Erica Chakowski, which is a good and needed reminder that with new capabilities come new risks. Here she talks about and gets quotes from security experts on HTML5. The main shift from older generations of this technology, the one that browsers utilize in order to represent the increasingly rich capabilities of the web, is shifting to putting code and processing much more on the client machines rather than in the past where it's been the server doing the heavy lifting. All of this in service to better emulate native capabilities closer to desktop applications. This unfortunately means there is more pressure on browsers and more likely to be more concerning vulnerabilities or just more moving parts in a modern browser as a consequence of the adoption of HTML5. App developers taking advantage of HTML5 need to be aware of these potential risks now, something that I guess they're not really doing a good job of, and as the article mentions, aren't actually explicitly being trained upon, something that they should be. For starters, one risk comes in the form of use of local storage, the ability to ask the browser to hang on to more than just what we've been able to do in the past in the form of a cookie, usually just a simple identifier, some small token of information. This is done, this rich local storage, in order to speed up data-rich web applications so that a large amount of data can be downloaded once and reused over and over over much longer periods of time. The risk here, though, is not with escaping the browser as such, but in and of itself, what's actually stored through this capability and who has access to it. Bugs and security of local storage could expose anything an app decides to store there. This isn't to say that such storage should be avoided, but should be used very carefully. Another more obvious concern arises from access to sensors and local services. We've already seen any number of problems with access to webcams from Flash. These same issues could just as easily apply to a browser, and not just cameras, but anything the browser is allowed to access, like for instance a GPS. Worse, an aspect that I've actually discussed in other pieces, is that for mobile browsers, as the article points out, there are less developed conventions on how to interact with users to expose warnings when it's appropriate to do so, and seek out permissions when accessing those capabilities, when there may be some risk associated in doing so. The third area discussed in the article is a little less obvious to the end user, but relates to changes under HTML5 to make web mashups much easier. That is, the combination of different server-side capabilities, usually exposed through a JavaScript library served up by some third party. Assuming too much trust of these third parties can greatly magnify the risk to the end user and highlights how important security in design and development of these applications needs to be for the average web developer undertaking them. The good news is all of these problems have been solved before in other spaces with the adoption of other new technologies. The bad is that we don't seem to be learning from that history that a piece like this needs to be written in the first place. Continuing a recent run of excellent journalism at Ars Technica on the security of passwords, Casey Johnston looks at the question of password complexity versus length. She starts by reminding us of the received wisdom that passwords combining unusual characters are generally considered safer, harder to crack. The first problem with such passwords is that they are harder also for average people to remember to use correctly. Worse, Johnston points to two studies, one from 2011 and another from 2012, that defy the received wisdom. She explains first some hard numbers around the difficulties in using such passwords, that not only are they harder to remember, but they're also even harder to create correctly in the first place. This all informs frustration by users that may leave them in a less secure space if they aren't able to comply with the password policy. At least for three different password policies as such and two cracking tools, the studies also suggest that the length has more to do with security than strange characters. Passwords here came in 8 or 16 character varieties, and the 8 character ones were also split into those requiring numbers, punctuation, and mixed case, and those that did not. The longer but simpler passwords were consistently harder to crack, both for a cracker using character frequency techniques and one using a training set of data. The latter reminds me of the last piece in this vein from Ars Technica that I discussed, where the secondary danger of password database breaches was explored. Namely, the more passwords, secure and otherwise, available to trainable cracking tools like the one in this piece, the less secure even complex and hard to guess passwords become. Johnston concludes with a couple of suppositions by one of the study's authors. Longer passwords may be harder to crack because of their relatively lower quantity in past breaches. There are just less of them available in the training data. This is an advantage that will weaken over time as long passwords are used more and more password data stores are inevitably leaked or stolen. Like bit lengths for crypto keys, the other reason is that longer passwords drastically increase the number of possible passwords, making guessing them harder on volume. There is no absolute secure approach to passwords, but this one resonates with a somewhat recent XKCD comic, the one about the correct horse battery staple, about longer, easier to remember passwords. So something to consider when setting password policies on sites that you control and are developing for, and when creating your own passwords with an eye towards their security. Here are the news stories that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website at thecommandline.net. I've talked at length on my thoughts about second adopters. Namely, these are the people who come to an interest between the earliest adopters and the wide interest from what we consider the mainstream. In that monologue, I was talking about technology adoption, but there are clearly parallels in other places such as the maker movement, folks into doing for themselves in all kinds of interesting ways, from repair to creating entirely new physical widgets and projects. Corey at Boing Boing shared a good example of the second adopters in the makerspace. A London-based social enterprise and charity, the Restart Project, has been working for a year solid to popularize certain ideas from the maker movement. The main method they're using are restart parties, kind of like Linux InstallFest or crypto parties. People of all levels of interest and experience can learn specifically about repairing their devices and also perhaps how to make better buying choices. The implication is a hands-on knowledge of repair can lead to buying more easily repaired gadgets or ones that are more sturdy, requiring less repair over time. The project site includes information and materials for anyone interested in throwing their own restart party, so it's also designed to be distributed and shared, communally owned and run. This is not the only idea of its kind. Anil Dash and friends launched a website some time ago called Last Year's Model. Their angle was that it isn't necessary to participate in the upgrade treadmill, the constant urge to have the latest and greatest models of phones, computers, whatever. As a consequence, they also considered what a world with a slower pace of the development and release of gadgets might be like, in terms of electronics designed to not only last, but to wear well. The analogy they used was the fine handcrafted wooden, leather, and even metal objects, where the constant use would actually soften the objects, giving them an attractive patina. Janet Gunter and Hugo Villari are behind Restart, and between them have a deeper background in developing countries and socioeconomic development than necessarily Anil Dash and his compatriots with the other comparable project. It seems to me that Janet and Hugo's interest here is at least as much in sustainability as it is a criticism of how wasteful and myopic consumerism is in the developed world. Corey's post included some impressive high-level stats on a year of work for Restart. They've thrown 27 restart parties involving and empowering over 500 Londoners of all ages, backgrounds, and groups, and saving an approximate 393 kilograms of electronics from waste, which is roughly, I like this, the weight of a polar bear. I remember hearing a radio piece some time ago as well about an engineer of the last generation, or maybe the one before, comparing the electronics that he grew up with, crystal radio sets, things like that, with their modern descendants. Sadly, technology has become less apparent, harder to repair on one's own. I'm heartened that despite that design trend, to then not only see makers, whose interests aren't just repair, but also the creation of new things, but also projects like this, like Restart, and sites and communities like iFixit. As much as today's device makers may want us to believe we are all fine with hermetically sealed widgets, there is at least a vocal and now growing minority who are standing up to say otherwise. Science Now was one of several places to cover a story about research that could allow cell phones to use sound to see in some sense, like a bat or a dolphin. What is clear in reading the article is that while work in this field is relatively new, it has actually been going on for the better part of a decade. The main interest is in using sound to be more efficient about simply measuring spaces. The work here was led by Ivan Dokmanik of the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. Their contribution, described in the article, seems to be pretty simple. By ignoring echoes below a certain size and making one key assumption, they are able to approximate the distance and angle of surfaces with a surprisingly high degree of accuracy. Their key assumption is to basically treat the echoes as inverse images of the sound source, simplifying measurement calculations. Work before theirs used either very constrained spaces or what sounds like rather elaborate microphone rigs, ones that simply wouldn't be practical for anyone wanting to use this outside of a laboratory setting. Their experiments used four simple microphones and a sound source as modest as a person snapping their fingers or popping a balloon. The computation involved sounds pretty reasonable, hence the discussion of using it on phones. Really, what they've done, as the article explains, could be used in any number of devices, anything with the necessary sensors and enough computing power. To test their work, the team took their setup to the Lausanne Cathedral in Switzerland. It is hard to imagine anything that would be more challenging. Cathedrals are intentionally designed with acoustically challenging surfaces, from the choir designed to allow voices to carry throughout the space, to the main space itself, which usually dampens sound to encourage silent contemplation, to create a sort of oral sense of awe. Any given cathedral is also scattered with columns, decorations, and all kinds of surfaces that would be far more challenging than a controlled lab or even a lecture hall. The algorithms still managed with a high degree of success, suggesting that they are ready for any number of interesting real-world applications. The article suggests several, from architectural measurement of spaces to figuring out ideal placements of sound systems like mics and speakers. The phone angle that many people mentioned in other coverage of this work is there's an important bit that was overlooked in the headlines, that anyone wanting to do this with phones would need at least four of them in order to do the job properly. But that's not necessarily a big constraint. It's not hard to imagine for the sorts of technical work mentioned, more kind of a considered design of spaces, that would be easy to come by, but it isn't exactly the first impression that a lot of the headlines have given, say perhaps of one person with one phone virtually seeing a space through sound, like the animal analogs to which this is being compared. Extreme Tech was one outlet to describe some interesting research by Dutch and Chinese scientists. I've shared many stories about the wonder material graphene. My interest is primarily in its electrical properties as a possible computing substrate. It has any number of interesting properties beyond just the electrical, such as its incredible thinness, forming as it does in sheets of a single atom thickness. Usually this is relevant to materials science, as that sheet is also disproportionately strong, one of the strongest materials for its size and configuration. What the team here have done, though, is to effectively use graphene as paper. The pencil they used, rather than the more common formulation of carbon in the traditional form of graphite, was the electron beam from a scanning transmission electron microscope. Ordinarily, to create or write at nanoscale structures of single-digit nanometers, one of two approaches is used. Traditionally, lithography is applied, masking off of materials where a resist is needed, where we don't want to write a structure or create a structure, and then exposing them to energy, usually in the form of some wavelength of light. Another approach being explored more recently is from the bottom up, self-assembling structures. Each have their limitations, with lithography struggling to get below tens of nanometers. Self-assembly is still relatively new, and reliability and repeatability are difficult. The combination here is a little bit of a stretch in my opinion, though I suppose technically it's true. The electron beam disrupts the regular structure of the graphene. If you've seen the layout of this, it's like a hex paper. The resulting freed carbon bonds then reform in an essentially random fashion, disrupting that regular pattern. This creates areas of what are called amorphous carbon within the otherwise regular recurring structure of hexagonally bonded carbon atoms. at a slightly coarser scale, backing off the zoom, these amorphous sections are actually incredibly high resolution. You have to bear in mind that each of those hexagons is 6 atoms in size. I suppose the comparison is to circuit traces, which are 25 times the size of the features we're talking about here. It isn't clear to me how this will be applied as a storage medium as such, which is how it's being reported, unless they mean in the broadest sense of making durable marks that are stored. The examples shown in images in the article are effectively low-tech letters etched in the graphene. If we want ultra-dense but still written records, printed records, which actually makes a certain amount of sense for archival purposes like the work undertaken by the Long Now Foundation, then this approach seems promising, though it has certain limitations still. A stem is a room-sized piece of equipment, and as the article notes, unlikely to be miniaturized anytime soon. This limits the use of graphene as a storage medium to very special cases. The article compares this work to hard drives, something that's very pedestrian, noting that despite the marked difference in storage density, traditional spinning magnetic media and newer flash storage devices are still immensely more practical and much more portable. Despite this comparison, the piece doesn't discuss the challenges to using this approach for digital storage of information. So far, I've just talked about literally writing out information. It isn't clear if an encoding scheme could be developed that is as reliable as existing media. Would this essentially be an optical medium like CDs and DVDs, where the etched shapes would be on or off bits in a regular pattern? I suppose that makes a bit more sense, and that comparison is, I think, closer in the particulars. If you understand how dye-based or plastic-based media in optical discs actually works, that it's pits or marks. Some of the other headlines I saw for this claimed storage on the order of petabytes, which again would make it best suited for cold storage, I think, for not fast access, easy access, but for long haul, hanging onto information, backing up massive libraries and other data collections, rather than being useful even without the size of a stem, say, on our desk for warm or immediate access storage. Daniela Hernandez at Wired wrote about a possible key breakthrough in artificial intelligence. She described a recent insight and follow-up work by Yoshua Bengio. Bengio? Might be Bengio. Works in a subdiscipline of artificial intelligence called deep learning. Opposed to trained systems like artificial neural networks, deep learning aims to bootstrap AI without the intervention of human input. Usually, large amounts of already labeled data are needed, as in the example mentioned in the article of how to identify cats in photos. This is something where Google actually was able to show off some pretty impressive performance from an artificial neural network. The problem is obvious that the amount of unlabeled data far outstrips that which is suitable for training purposes. Having read about more traditional, better accepted approaches, there are other problems. Trained systems can get stuck on local optima, unable to work on too varied data. One example I recall, clearly for military applications, was a system that did fine with initial datasets in spotting tanks. When the data was broadened, bringing more real-world information in, it inexplicably started performing far worse. The problem is it was hard to know if the algorithm was really spotting the thing of interest, here in this example a tank, or there were other similarities in the training data it honed in on, like particular patterns of foliage, of light on ground, of who knows what. If the latter, when more data was introduced, it didn't have those other incidental traits, hence causing the system's performance and accuracy to suddenly drop off. The article is scant on how Bengio's month-old insight differs, but the field is clearly focused broadly on overcoming the limits of trained algorithms by more closely emulating how humans learn, or at least to the best of our understanding. The one thing the article does mention is intuition, though the only definition it provides is processing that humans do without consciously accessing that processing. My guess is this relates to fuzzy logic and similar techniques that can deal with partial data. This seems borne out by the example images included in the article. It also hints at how deep learning can overcome many problems of older approaches, such as object recognition and machine vision. Rotating a simple coffee mug in 3 dimensions provides immense challenges to some machines, as the presented 2-dimensional aspect varies so dramatically from one frame to the next. They're not easily categorized as representing the same object. An intuitive approach suggests that as long as there are some consistencies, a deep learning program would make the necessary leaps based on scant data. Bengio is collaborating with researchers at NYU and Google and seems to be in good company as a thought leader. I'm especially encouraged that he seems to be a systematic thinker and primarily a researcher. He is quoted saying he is less concerned with commercial applications than with finding solutions to the problems holding back the field. The article hits on several obvious and, to be frank, lucrative applications if Bengio's work manages to pan out. Right now, they've had good success, though no specifics on the accuracy rates, and just with small data sets. The next step, however, is clear and a critical one to see how his ideas work with bigger data sets. If he can manage to hit on techniques that can trickle into everyday software to the point where autocorrect is more contextual and less arbitrary, that alone would be an immense improvement that I think everyone would appreciate. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've discussed before. I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. Microsoft drew a lot of fire with the launch of its new Xbox One gaming console for policies requiring an always-on connection and a prohibition on used games. Ars Technica was one of several outlets to report a complete reversal on those policies, explicitly yielding to the backlash. They are allowing used games to work exactly as they did before on the Xbox 360. Owners will have to download an update in order to support the offline mode, but at least that is now possible and far less onerous than the alternative. The cache really seems to be some game and content sharing options that the Redmond giant is tying to their original policies. It seems like a better trade-off to me, as it doesn't take away known value for some proposed value in a service or set of features that are not guaranteed to be used or even well-received by a majority of users. I wonder if Microsoft's apparent wane in the face of new software and device makers has made them more responsive for fear of losing further ground, or this is just fear of competition, since Sony, as much as they've made similar mistakes in the past, clearly capitalized on the original policies around the Xbox One in their own launch of their new console, the PlayStation 4. Either way, this is a win for consumers and remains to be seen if it is part of a larger trend of respecting console owners, game players, and any number of third parties like indies and the brick-and-mortar stores where used game sales thrive. Slashdot was one of several places to follow the retail launch of the Ouya. This is a $99 Android-powered game console that was supported by, originally, a Kickstarter project, one that reached an astonishing $8.6 million of funding. During its initial run-up, it secured deals with major retailers including GameStop and Amazon. It launched on the 25th of June in retail outlets and quickly sold out of several of them, most notably Amazon. For full disclosure, I was one of the original pledge backers of the Kickstarter and mentioned getting mine the very day before the wider retail launch. I'm happy with mine so far, comparing it very favorably to the gaming I do on my tablet, rather than to the much more expensive consoles on which I gave up a while ago. I'm optimistic it will find a viable niche, whether it has any impact on the big consoles. There is also the possibility it will do something utterly surprising. That's my most fervently held hope, as the software and hardware are completely open, allowing who knows what kind of applications down the road. Expect a more in-depth review of the console, too, of course, based on the time that I've had it as a future feature of the podcast. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoy the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/gnupg-fingerprints. The next episode will be a feature cast due out in a week, and most likely will include an interview with friend of the podcast, Chris Miller. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits, and you share your changes under the same license.